Welcome to the Drop Time Report. Turn up the volume and listen to amazing stories about big bucks and the hunters who harvested them. Here is your host, outdoor writer, Tracy Breen.
On this week's show, we're going to have on Dr. Mike Reed from Iowa. Mike recently shot a buck that scores over 200 inches in Iowa. Obviously, Iowa is one of the best whitetail states in the nation. So it's not uncommon to have a hunter kill a buck that size. But to retrieve the buck the way Mike had to retrieve this buck is truly a story for the grandkids. So that'll be one of the more interesting parts of his story, what happened after the shot. One cool thing about this 200-inch buck, it was only 4.5 years old, and he's going to go into detail about why he chose to shoot a 4.5-year-old deer when, in most cases, he likes to wait until a buck is 5.5 before he shoots it. And it has a lot to do with his neighbors, so it just goes to show you whether you're managing a small piece of property or a really large one, dealing with neighbors and hunting pressure is something all hunters have to deal with. But before we get Mike on the show, I want to thank my sponsors. My title sponsor, Redneck Blinds, Fourth Arrow Camera Arms. If you're into filming your hunt, check out Fourth Arrow Camera Arms. Windscent is a revolutionary new scent dispersal system that actually vaporizes deer urine. Morel Targets, some exciting news. We're going to give away a Morel target on this episode of the Drop Time Report. Pretty simple. The moment you hear this, the fifth person to send me an email will receive a free Yellow Jacket target. In order to send me an email, visit my website, which is tracybreen.com, TracyBreen.com, and then just hit contact me and send me an email. The fifth person to do so will receive a free target. Also want to thank Huntworth Clothing, Pine Ridge Archery, Lucky Buck Mineral, Grim Reaper Broadheads, Schaefer Performance Archery, the makers of the XV Arrow Rest, Illinois Connection Outfitters in Pike County, Illinois, Outdoorsmans, makers of great backpacks and tripods, and Wilderness Athlete. If you're tired of drinking sugary drinks and you want to try something out that could actually help you lose a little weight, check out wildernessathlete.com. They have a variety of nutritional products. One of my favorites is their Hydrate and Recover drink. Enter Drop 10 at checkout and receive a discount. Now let's go ahead and get Mike on the show. Welcome to the Drop Time Report, Mike. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for taking time to be on. Being a doctor and being on call, I know life can probably be hectic for you.
Yeah, very hectic all the time, not to mention the five little kids.
How does a guy who's a doctor and has five little kids and the wife is an anesthesiologist, how do you find time to spend 5 minutes in a tree stand?
Yeah, my wife is awesome. That's the first thing I should say. She's always supported my passion and my obsession, and that's exactly what it is. I've been into it since I was born. It's in me. But since a very young age, I grew up in Louisiana and hunted public land for 20 years, and even not seeing a deer all year long, I still just love to be out there as much as I can. And it's just the thing I'm most passionate about in life. And so everything else in my life sort of feeds into that and is planned around that and making time for me to spend time out there.
Now, being a doctor, obviously you have less time than most probably to hunt. So are you one of these guys who really, you know, picks the perfect days in the rut to go and you stay away when the odds of success are much less?
Yeah, I try to. It's a little bit hard having a clinic. You know, I wish I had a job that I could, the day of or like 2 days before, 3 days before, when I see the forecast, I could make arrangements to not be at work. But what I've done over the years is I try to speckle my vacation days throughout the end of October and November. So I'll take 2 to 3 days off each week. And I try to see all my patients and do my surgeries in working 2 to 3 days. And I'll do that starting the end of October. And so obviously I'll hit plenty of days that maybe the weather's not perfect and the hunting's not great, but by spreading it out over 3 to 4 weeks, I usually have some good days of rut hunting, as opposed to just taking a week and having 1 9-day stretch and hoping for the best. I've had better success kind of speckling my vacation.
Okay. And this buck you killed was over 200 inches, roughly, give or take a few inches. What day did you kill him?
November 5th.
November 5th, okay. And tell us a little bit of the history you had with the deer. You think he's 4.5, which is amazing that he's that big at 4.5, but he obviously was on the radar screen at 3.5.
Right, so... You know, we bought this farm in 2017 and had a nice crop of bucks on it and had good hunting that year and shot a nice mature buck and didn't have any obvious deer that looked like this. 2018 rolled around, we had some flooding, and in Velvet, we got pictures of amazing looking young deer. He looked like an obvious 3.5-year-old. Multiple points, very similar to what his rack is this year, just like a basket rack almost. And, but you know, 16 or 17 points. And looking back, there's at the year before there, we think we may have found them, but, it's really stretching out, like, you know, looking at the brow tines and things like that. And it would be like a little tiny 2.5-year-old, but anyway, fairly certain in 2018, he was a 3.5-year-old, a deer we ended up nicknaming Prodigy because it's like, wow, look at this really obviously young deer and lots of points, lots of potential. And didn't live on us, but later in the season kind of moved in. We had planted some beans and left them there. And as everything got harvested around in 2018, he moved onto our land. And we ended up getting multiple pictures of him throughout the year. Never had any encounters, but he was one that we're really looking for this year. We put cameras out. And then it was after Velvet. It was late September, early October. We got our first picture of him, and very obviously the same deer, but blew up. I mean, 40 to 50 inches. And we thought he'd for sure be 190s. Yeah, exactly. We thought for sure he'd be 190s. And then, you know, thought there'd be a possibility with all the points and that he would touch 200. And you know, I actually had an encounter with him on the 2nd, November 2nd. When I saw him in person, I thought, yeah, you know, he looks like a 200-inch deer. And sure enough, when I killed him and got up to him, I thought, I wonder if he'll touch 200 just because his frame's a little bit smaller. His beams are actually pretty short. They're about 22 inches, but he had enough points there, 19 scoreables, and it added up. You know, it broke the mark.
Wow. Now talk about the fact that, you know, in deer management land that a lot of people live in Iowa, everybody wants to wait until that deer is 5.5 years old, but you're kind of playing, you know, Russian roulette. So kind of talk about that tug of war of trying to decide whether or not to shoot him and what made you finally decide to pull the trigger.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, a little bit of backstory on my hunting. I mean, I grew up in Louisiana hunting public land, not managed land, and you know, grew up with the rifle hunting with the mentality, like a lot of states, you know, if it's brown, it's down, we're trying to get meat. And then as my passion blossomed and I started getting access to better places, I mean, when I was younger, we started with 3.5 or older, and I just slowly progressed to trying to get bigger deer. And I've shot lots of good deer with my bow over the years. And, I became a landowner about 5 years ago, my first piece of ground. And my goal there was to try to manage for mature bucks and whether they have big antlers or not, but knowing through, you know, wildlife biology and my experience in the past, if you get them to 5.5, you know, you're trying to get 90% of their antler potential out of them by doing that. And so my knee-jerk reaction is always to try to get deer to 5.5. And I own this farm with Jared Mills, one of the guys at Midwest Whitetail, and we both sort of have the same idea there. And we definitely were torn when we got pictures of this buck, knowing, hey, this is potentially a once in a lifetime deer. And we only have 200 acres and we're not in a big co-op where everyone, will agree to pass the deer. I mean, the neighbors have shot good deer, but they'll say things like, well, my biggest is 184. And if I get a shot at something bigger, then, you know, I'm going to take it. Or, you know, some of the areas are heavily pressured. Some of the farmers let lots of shotgun hunters in, and it's all fine and dandy and good tradition. And we had to consider that into our thought process. At first, you know, you never know if you're even going to see the deer. So it's easy to say, well, let's not target him. Let's not hunt him. But see, you know, it'd be great to see him in a year at 5.5. Maybe he's one of these really special deer that's going to blow in the 250. And that's kind of where we left it. And I like the concept of getting all these bucks to 5.5. Well, he moves back and he moves into the farm. He didn't really live on our farm all summer and even through October, but late October, we got a few pictures of him in daylight. And I said, oh, you know, he's moved in here and we got a lot of does on our ground and lots of cover. And so it felt like he was going to probably be there for the rut. And, November 2nd, I had this encounter with him, and Jared and I had talked about it in the past, and we kind of left it at, let's just plan on not shooting him, knowing that it would be difficult if we saw him, and kind of keeping our fingers crossed that maybe we wouldn't necessarily be tested, but, so deer comes out at 250 yards, and I'm like, oh, cool, we'll get to film him and get some footage and build that history, and then he comes all the way into 35 yards, and we're filming him, and, you know, I passed the deer.
Now, what are you thinking?
Like, oh, man, I mean, was that hard to do? I'm like, yeah. I mean, I didn't really think about it. I was like, well, we said we were going to shoot him, so I didn't shoot him. But now in hindsight, I think, boy, if I don't get another chance that deer and the neighbors kill him, like, boy, that's going to hurt, you know. And kind of went back and forth for 3 days talking about it, thinking about it, and, you know, spoke to a couple of the neighbors and realized that no one – we showed some trail cam pictures, and we're trying to fill people out for if they'd be – consider trying to get him through another year. And the general census, which you can't blame anybody, was that, you know, they're going to shoot that deer if they get a chance, because no one's killed a 200 inch deer. And so I said, well, I mean, I've got to shoot him if it comes in the bow range, right? And Jared was hunting the big deer, and he's obviously like, I mean, I can't blame you for wanting to shoot him. He's like, it'd be great to see him next year, but you know, if you need to shoot him, shoot him. And I still had my fingers kind of crossed that I wouldn't be tempted again, but I was like, I'm not going to hunt him. I don't want to shoot him with a gun. I really want to see him next year because, wow, what could he be? But, you know, if I keep getting chances at this 200th year with my bow, I'm gonna take it. And so we kind of left it at that. And I was still hunting that buck we called Merino, which is a 6.5-year-old we've had pictures of for previous few years. And it's just one of those farms where you hunt in the rut spot. I mean, you're bound to see the bucks, you know, and so he's kind of that deer that came through that day. But I also was threatened by my wife. She's like, hey, I'm at home with these 5 kids and you're hunting a bunch and you're passing 200 a year. You might as well come sit at home. So,
you can go sleep on the couch, right?
Yeah. She's like, hey, I don't know what you're out there doing, but if you're not shooting that deer, you might as well come home. Anyway, it was pretty funny. All my buddies back home were like, what has gotten into you, man? And I lost sleep over it a couple nights thinking, going back and forth about it, but eventually decided that it was the right decision in a heavily pressured area, that if I get a chance with a kind of a once in a lifetime buck with a bow, I might as well take it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened.
So kind of highlight, you know, the day you killed him, you know, the scenario that presented was allowed you to, you know, get a shot at him.
Yeah, sure. So I encountered him on the weekend, and then I had to work a couple of days per what I was describing earlier. I kind of speckle my days off, days on. And the wind was right to hunt my favorite spot on the farm, which is a little narrow timber stretch in a bend in the river that is between the river and a slough. And this is where I killed a mature buck in 2017 and had other mature buck encounters in the rut. So it's a really nice cruising spot. And so me and my cameraman, we just went set up that morning in the dark. And as the leaves fall off the trees, it's a really open area. And it's we get in this old cottonwood. And there's actually a stand in it from the previous owner. It's about 10 feet off the ground. And so what I've done later into the fall is I actually get in that stand and then I do a hanging hunt out of that stand, which sounds kind of crazy, but that's what I did. Climb up into that stand, and then I put my lone wolf sticks and my lone wolf stands up. So I was probably 30 feet up in the air, just because with two of us in the cameras, it's easy to get picked off. And so we're way high up in there, just hunting this little pinch spot. And the movement was slow that morning. We saw one doe at daylight, and then it was a couple hours before we saw anything. Had two little bucks cruise by at 9:30, and we're just planning on sitting most of the day, catching that late morning and midday cruising. And we have a coyote issue on this farm. It's okay. Just tons of coyotes, and we had been seeing them almost every hunt, but not getting many chances to shoot them. And I saw a coyote coming out of the timber, and I decided, hey, let me see if I can get him into bow range and shoot him. And so I actually just did a little squeak, a little rabbit squeal with my mouth, and he just turned on a dime and came in, and so I shot him. And he ran off in back into the cover, back into the timber. And I knocked another arrow, and we were actually looking at the footage to just assess the shot because he didn't fall over in sight. So I'm trying to see where my arrow hit him. And then I could hear grunting and a chase coming. And as soon as I put my binos up, I could tell it was this deer. And so we got ready, and he chased the doe right into 15 yards. And I was able to stop him. And yeah, exactly, right under the tree. And as you know, with bow hunting, I mean, being really high up, there's a couple of risks. If you aim at the heart at 15 yards, you're liable to hit them pretty low just because of that real steep angle. You catch brisket and you might not get well into the lungs. And if you aim high, try to double lung them, and you're just shooting right behind the leg there, you're liable to hit the shoulder blade. And so I just aimed a little bit behind that area and shot him. And it was a double lung shot, but back of the lungs. And then the deer, you know, runs off, and he's actually still grunting chasing this doe, which was remarkable. I mean, they're juiced up on testosterone, obviously, but he ran off into our thick peninsula. So we have the river goes completely around, and it's a big peninsula that's a few hundred yards long. And he just ran off in the same direction the coyote did. And I got down, checked the arrow, had bright red blood, bubbles, you know, blood immediately on the ground. So felt good about the shot. My initial reaction was, oh, it's a little bit back, but the arrow indicated that it was double lung. And so I was pretty excited about that. And we just called the boys and waited, and everybody got there for the track job. And we picked up the trail. It was a few hours after I shot him. And that's where it got interesting.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was... As we track him into the peninsula, we end up getting crisscrossed on the coyote blood trail.
Oh, boy.
And, yeah, there's lots of people, and there's all this blood over here, and, you know, there's four of us on the trail. And so, anyway, somehow we're following this nice blood trail, blood spraying out of both sides, really easy to follow. And then ended up continued tracking down, and I found a broken arrow, and the arrow had stuck in the coyote. And so, and on the deer, I got a pass through and had the whole arrow on the ground. So immediately I was like, oh man, this is the coyote arrow. And then we started kind of reassessing and ended up backtracking and finding where the blood trails had crisscrossed and then getting back on the deer trail, which he had turned to the south while the coyote had gone to the west. And so anyway, that was like an hour ordeal. Got back on the deer trail. And again, easy to follow, good blood trail, follow him all the way through the timber, and ended up finding a bed. And that was a little concerning, obviously, and it was bedded right near the river. And it had good lung blood in it, frothy, bubbly blood. And he gets out of that bed, obviously, and the trail goes into the river. And it's a pretty big river, one of the major river systems in Iowa.
Okay.
And the blood trail just goes right into the river.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, exactly. And so I've hunted in Louisiana. I've had to get in rivers, cross them, not cross them, you know, drown, drift away. We've lost them. We've recovered some, stuck in log jams, et cetera. And so my mind is wandering about, I've just shot this 200-ish deer that I was on the fence about shooting, and now I'm going to lose them in the river. So you can imagine emotionally, that was fairly rough. But I decided to go down the river a little ways on our side of the river and just check the bank for blood to see if he got in the water and then changed his mind and kind of came back. And we jumped down on the sandbar there, and there's blood immediately, but there's no deer tracks, and there's fresh coyote tracks. And so this is really interesting and not really portrayed in the video production. just because at this point I'm just baffled by what I'm finding, and it's not making sense. But in hindsight, what I believe happened, because we didn't start trailing the deer for about 3 hours, and it was a double lung shot. I think he died relatively soon. But the coyote that I shot, I believe, found him bedded down and jumped him. And the deer jumped in the river, and the coyote jumped down on the sandbar. And it's the coyote blood and the coyote tracks that are all along the sandbar as the deer is floating away. And obviously the coyote didn't get in the water. And
wow, you can't make this story up, can you?
Yeah, we were sitting there laughing, saying, what planet are we on? I mean, obviously you can't make it up, but if it wasn't filmed, nobody would believe it. Yeah. But I ended up calling the landowner across the river. And, you know, there's rules in Iowa where if you're on an active blood trail, you can legally follow it onto someone's land without a weapon. But I didn't know if the blood trail was on the other side. And we could have gone get a boat and got in the river and gone check the bank in that way. But I thought, hey, if this deer made it across, let me just call him up. And he was nice enough, gave me permission. We got in the trucks. We drove around and went to that sandbar. And we're just checking for signs that the deer actually made it across. And we didn't find any track or blood on the other side. And we looked about 200 to 300 acres of the bank really close. And so my assumption was that he didn't make it across, and that he died in the river and he's floated downstream somewhere. And so we started just walking down the bank, glassing the river, trying to see if he was stuck on anything. And I ended up spotting in a log jam what looked like a deer, but it was pretty difficult to tell. I mean, it's just a little piece of the hind quarter that was sticking out of the water, and it looked like hair. And he had just enough air in him to stay afloat. I mean, the current was pretty strong. The water was really deep. And we ended up getting the drone out of the truck and flying it over there and confirming that it definitely was a deer. But all we could see was the hind end. The rest of the deer was up under the log jam. And so I was not for certain that it was this buck, but just assuming, I mean, how many dead deer are floating in the river?
Yeah. Odds are good.
Yeah, exactly. And so we talked about it for a while, getting late in the day. We were about 6 hours into the track job, and I elected to swim over there, which maybe is not the smartest thing to do, but I have some swimming experience and some cold water experience. I was a lifeguard and swim team and all that sort of good stuff. But
So you're Michael Phelps' little brother is what you're saying.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. the nearest boat was about a 2 hour round trip. And I thought, what if it's not him? And we spend all that time going to get this boat, you know? So my initial thought was, I got all these guides here. Let me swim over there and pull this deer out. And if it was him too, I didn't want him to sink. And I didn't know if that was only a matter of time. Obviously I had a big hole in him. And, so anyway, I ended up assessing the risks and assessing my route to get over there. And I brought a rope with me and I had a bunch of dry clothes. My biggest concern as a physician was hypothermia. Obviously it was the air temperature that morning was about 28 and the high was 43 and it was about 40 degrees. So that water was cold. I mean, we had a cold November here in Iowa and that water was really frigid.
How do you get yourself in there? Like I think about swimming in cold water when it's 65, you know, the first swim of the summer, man, that must have been tough.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the thought of recovering a potential 200 steer helped, but
that warmed your spirits.
That's right. Yeah, lots of just mental, just kind of psyching myself up. I mean, I've done some. I'd like to think that residency training and things like that in your life teach you how to be, you know how to suffer is one way to say it.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, it's like some mental toughness and. I've had some mountain climbing experience, some glacier summits and things that, you know, you just kind of put your mind to it and just do it. And I thought, well, this is going to be a short-lived experience and kind of just revved myself up, tried to get my heart rate up, warm my body a little bit and knew that I'm going to dunk myself and take off and get her done. And that's what I did. I swam over there, climbed up on the log, was able to, I approached it from the side so that the current wouldn't, you know, pull me under like where he was. And so I was able to swim to the side of that tree, get up on the tree and then walk up the tree and pull him out of the water, confirm it was him, and get him secured on top of that tree.
So what was your thought the moment you realized it was him? I mean, you know, was it
just pure elation and relief, you know. As I mentioned, I mean, the struggle of, you know, really wanting to shoot him because he's a giant deer with a bow and I've never done that before, but really wanting to see him, what he could be next year, and then making that decision and doing it, and then coming to terms with potentially losing him in the river, and then all of a sudden spotting him and then getting over there and confirming, hey, I got him, and I've got him secured, and I've got him tied to the log, and I've got him recovered, was a huge relief. Yeah, just a weight off the shoulders. So
that's amazing. So was his head like pointing down, like towards the bottom of the river then?
Correct. Yeah. The head was probably 2 feet submerged under the logs. And so I had to pull him back up against the current and get him up on that log, which, you know, in the video, it looks like I just swim over and lift him up and swim back, which that wasn't the case. It was about probably 15 minutes of me yanking on him until I could get him up. I mean, it's a 250-pound deer that's full of water. So it was, at one point I looked over and said, "One of you guys want to swim over here and come help me?"
And of course they didn't.
You're right. They're like, look at me like, yeah, no.
I think you got it. I think you got it there, Dr.
You're
Mike. Yeah.
Exactly. So thankfully I had that rope. I had a 40-foot rope with me, and, I was able to get his head up out of the water just enough to throw a loop around his antlers. And then I kind of used a pulley system. I put the rope around one of the big roots sticking up in the air, and then I'd take, you know, pull it and then lift him and pull it and lift him. And eventually I got him where I could get him over the edge onto that log and let some of that water drain out of him.
Okay.
It was tough. It was exhausting. And then the decision was, do I leave him tied up here and then go get a boat and recover him? Or do I try to tugboat him back across? And, you know, I've floated deer across streams and rivers and bayous before, and I thought he'll float pretty well, and he did. So I had that rope around his antlers, and I put a fixed loop on the other end and kind of wore it like a sash where I could get out of it really easily, and swam until the rope got taut, and then I kind of just pulled him back across with me.
How wide's the river?
Ooh, 100 feet.
Okay.
You know, something like that, 100, 120 feet probably. I had a 40-foot rope, and, you know, thankfully we were on, again, it was like a hairpin turn in the river with a big peninsula, and that the land side that I was swimming back to was a nice big sandbar. Otherwise, all the riverbanks are a good 10 to 12 feet. And, you know, he actually was caught on the opposite bank. But it was a neighbor that owned that land, because he actually floated about 700 yards downriver. I ranged it with my rangefinder and figured out he floated about 700 yards before getting caught. And so by that time, he was a landowner or two downstream, and I didn't know who had that. And not to mention, we would have had to not only get permission, but come in there and try to winch him up the hill. And I thought it would just be easier to drag him back across. And so it was the full width of the river. And that 40-foot rope made it about halfway across, and then I just would pull him a little ways and then swim and pull him a little ways and swim. And eventually I could get my feet down, and that was helpful once I could touch, because then one of the guys walked out a little ways and gave me a hand, and we just hauled him in.
Wow, that's a story for the grandkids.
Exactly, yeah.
And you'll probably have lots of them, having five kids.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's a few things I do differently now as I've gone back, and my wife says we should double my life insurance. But I think keep a life vest in my truck, since I'm going to continue to be hunting that farm, and more rope, because the ideal thing would be to swim across, tie a rope to him, and then have the other guy just pull him across. But I only had about 40 feet of rope, and it would have been great to have about 100 feet. That would have made it a little bit, I think, safer and easier, but a buoy or something.
Yeah. So the million-dollar question is, did you find the coyote?
I did not, actually. And I'm not sure it was a lethal hit, which was a thing I was really trying to assess. you know, the arrow, I didn't get good penetration, and he kind of wheeled around whenever I shot him, and it stuck in him, and it was, the arrow barely penetrated. It stuck in something. I'm still not 100% sure, because the video camera wasn't really zoomed in on him very tight. And he ran off, and he covered, I'd venture to say 600 to 800 yards, and the blood trail was just like a drip. And, when the coyote blood trail came back to where the deer was and there was blood on the bank, I mean, I tried to follow it up the bank, but it just fizzled out. And, by the end of the night, by the time we actually got the deer out of the water and shot our interviews and got him loaded up and, went back around to the tree to pick up our bags and everything, it was, after dark. And, sure. I ended up not being able to get back on that blood trail.
Now, do you think he just bumped into your buck and that caused that chain of events? Or do you think he actually said, "Ooh, there's a buck bedded over here. You know, I'm going to go see if I can chew on him."
Yeah, I think he bumped into him. I mean, our peninsula is pretty tight, and it's narrow and long, and he ran into the peninsula. And he was, I think, coming back out of the peninsula on the south side and either caught his wind or just stumbled upon him or stumbled across the blood trail or something like that. But I think they randomly crossed paths. And, you know, my assumption is that's what made that deer get out of his bed. A double lung shot buck that's bedded down after running about 400 yards, you would, 9 times out of 10, you're going to find him in that bed.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was us that bumped him, because it was 4 hours later by the time we even figured out that he had crossed the peninsula, you know? And so I started tracking him about 3 hours after I shot him. We spent the first hour on the initial part of the trail, then got off on the coyote trail, then figured out we were on the coyote trail, then went back. And so by the time we actually got on the right blood trail and were headed his direction where he might have seen us and jumped up and went in the river, it was 4 hours later. And I don't think there's any way that deer was alive 4 hours after I shot him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a theory, obviously, but it just seems like with the coyote blood and the obvious sign right there on the creek bank that he stumbled across him. And I could envision that deer jumping in the river and the coyote jumping down on the sandbar and kind of watching him float away.
Yeah. Yeah. Probably true. Like you said, I mean, the deer was just desperate to get away from the coyote and jumped in the water.
Yeah, had just enough energy left in him to get up. And he actually, the bank right there is about 10 to 12 feet high. And you can see where his hoofs went into the mud and just slid all the way down, just right into the water.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, when you shot him, I mean, you're a doctor, you do surgery. I would say you're probably used to high stress situations. Realizing that this 200-inch deer was right in front of you, were your nerves kind of crazy, or are you a stone cold killer?
I stay pretty calm these days. When I decide I'm going to shoot something, I think I do pretty well staying calm, focusing on the shot. And the one thing I had to my advantage this time is, it all happened in seconds. I mean, the deer's grunting and chasing and heading my direction. Make the decision, he's coming in, you know, it's stop him, draw back, shoot. So you almost, you know, didn't have time to get nervous. It's not like one of these situations where they're 200 yards off feeding and they slowly work their way in and you get time to get worked up about it. But I can tell you after the shot, it set in pretty good. I was shaking pretty good in the tree with excitement.
Now, you've owned the land for what, 5 years, you're saying? 4 years?
This particular farm, 3 years. Yeah. Okay. It's our third season on it.
So have you done anything to make it, you know, enticing to the whitetails, or have you just kind of left it alone and it's produced this magical buck?
Yeah, it's actually, it's a farm that a physician friend of mine owned, and I bought it from him, and he owned it for 20 years and actually had, there's been three different 200-inch deer taken off of the place in the previous 20 years, and it just was great habitat. And it's a river bottom farm, and it was enrolled in the Wetland Reserve Program, which is this WRP program. It's that the, you know, the federal government basically does. And it was enrolled by the landowner that was two previous landowners ago in the 90s. And you get a one-time payment to enroll the land into the wetland for the remainder forever. And so it can never be taken out and you can never do anything with it. You can't farm it. You can't plant it. You can't do anything. And so it's all grown up in this wetland habitat, which is thick willow thickets and just marsh grass. And so naturally it's really good habitat and there's rich soil in the area and lots of good farm ground and lots of good genetics. Now, we were able to go to the NRCS office, which is the conservation office that is in control of like CRP contracts and these sorts of things, and develop what's called a compatibility use agreement, a CUA, that we want to use it, we want to make it better for wildlife, and there are certain things that it will let you do. Like they'll let you do some TSI work. And so Jared and I did do some timber stand improvement that first early spring, and then food plots. They let you do 5% in food plots. And so that's the main thing we did that the farm was lacking. You know, it has lots of natural browse, obviously, but just we got permission. We did 5% of 160 acres, because actually 160 of it is in the wetland. And that allowed us to put like 7 or 8 acres into food plots. And so we planted some, we drilled some beans in and do brassicas and different green plots just to try to give the deer everything they have. But they have all the water they need. They have all the cover they need. And the main thing that was lacking is food.
So did those few acres of food plots, you know, really make a big difference pulling in the deer?
Yeah, I think we hold more bucks through the winter, you know, and so I think we maybe save a few deer from leaving the property and getting some of that early winter gun pressure once they're leaving to go find a good solid food source by providing food on the farm. And then we just have a better chance of keeping them alive and healthy through the harsh Iowa winters.
Yeah, you guys can get some cold ones, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah. I mean, last year was terrible. We were finding deer frozen in their beds on public land last year. I mean, it was remarkable how harsh the winter was. And so having some good food sources, I think, helps just keep the herd as healthy as possible.
For sure. For sure. So where do you go from here? I mean, you got another 200 inch you're growing over there?
Yeah, one can only hope. Yeah, I've had an unbelievable year. I mean, just 10 days before that one, I shot a 173 on the same farm. And I don't need to kill another deer this year and to have the best year I've ever had. But I do have my late muzzy tag coming up, and I also hunt in the urban zone where I live. And so I've got a couple tags left this year. I'm working on those. I don't have any more giant deer like that, but I certainly have a couple good 5.5-year-old, 6.5-year-old bucks that I've got 3 years of history with, and be chasing after those guys.
So tell me in closing, when you were growing up in Louisiana, you know, what's a shooter down there? I mean, how big is a, you know, a really good deer?
Yeah, I mean, I used to just sit in my dad's office and admire this buck that he shot in 1988, which is 115-inch 10-point on public land, 120-inch 10-point, and just think how, wow, that's a giant deer, you know? And on public land down there, I mean, it's they do kill big deer. A little bit of backstory on that. I mean, in the 1900s, right around the turn of the century, the deer were all just about gone in Louisiana. And the state of Louisiana actually bought 100 deer from the state of Illinois, and they were barged down the Mississippi River and released. And so we actually have some Midwestern genetics down there. And we can get some really big body deer and some big racks, but it's pretty random. The main farm I hunt down there now is a really well-managed, large acreage property. And now, I mean, I don't hardly shoot deer down there unless they're 150, but that's lucky and special. You know, I mean, that's most of the hunting down there. If you get a mature buck that's 120, I mean, that's a great deer to take.
So all your hometown boys from back home, you're their hero now, huh?
Oh yeah, they like to remind me how lucky I am.
He's a superstar on Midwest Whitetail. Yeah,
I definitely feel very fortunate the way things have kind of unfolded. And obviously, my dream since being young was to own land and manage it for a mature deer herd and try to shoot big bucks. I've always just kind of been obsessed with it, and I'm living that dream, fortunately.
Yeah, you worked hard, you know, and had to chase the doctor dream first, obviously.
Yeah, I went back and forth. You know, I was one of those teenagers that thought, hey, I watch these hunters on TV, and I'm like, I'm going to be a professional hunter. And I thought, I don't want to make my job my passion, right? And so I said, let me do a job that can create financial stability and allow me to maybe own land and do those sorts of things. And that's worked out well for me.
That's probably the right choice. I've made a living in the hunting industry for 20 years, and I always tell people, be careful what you wish for, because when you make your hobby a job, it becomes a job.
It becomes a job, yeah. And so I have a very low-pressure situation. I mean, I film my hunts because I love doing it, and I love having them produced by the guys at 41 North. And, you know, I've been happy to give my footage over to Bill and the guys at Midwest Whitetail and have it on the show. But it's just great to have those memories that I can look back on in 20 years and 30 years and watch this video. And I mean, already my wife and kids and I, everyone's into hunting. My wife likes to hunt. I'm my oldest daughter shot a great buck last year, and she's 8. And all the kids at least have interest. Obviously, they're all really young, but I want to propagate that. And we look back at hunts from 3 years ago, and it's really fun to watch the little girls, you know, when my oldest was only 5 and she was helping track my bucks and that sort of stuff is just, it's really hard to beat. I really, really enjoy that. And it's going to be even better in 10 years, 20 years, when we can look back and watch these videos and lots of good memories.
Very cool. Well, thank you for doing the interview, and getting our schedules meshed was a little difficult, but we got it. So thank you for bending your schedule a little bit for me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I appreciate you having me. And thank you for being patient and accommodating, because I know it took a couple weeks and it's hectic, but we got it worked out.
Awesome. Well, thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
It sounds like Mike's piece of property is one of a kind, so I wouldn't be surprised if we ended up having him on the show again in the future with another 200-inch buck. On next week's show, we're going to have on Bill Winke. Bill needs no introduction, but he is the host of Midwest Whitetail. He's going to highlight a couple of the bucks that he has killed this fall. In the meantime, I'd appreciate it if you give me a positive review on iTunes or Google Play or wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. To learn more about me, visit my website, tracybreen.com. Until next time, have a great day.